There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I am your host, Matt Salmon, and once again, I am glad that you are able to join me here for another rousing edition of Cardboard Conversation. Of course, rousing and cardboard are very rarely utilized next to each other in a sentence. But we're going to dare to be different here on this podcast. And a little bit of a different setting for the podcast before we talk about our main topic this week. I'm actually doing this outdoors on my back patio. I normally seclude myself in a studio and, you know, make sure that the sound is nice and solid and silent, but it's just a nice day. I'm recording this in the morning. I'm getting my second Pfizer shot a little later on, so I may be down for the count tomorrow. So I'm going to enjoy the weather, and I'm going to enjoy the ability to function and enjoy just the birds. And yeah, even the noise from the distant highway. It must be the direction the wind is blowing here. There's a lot of noisy trucks apparently around my neighborhood. But anyways, if you hear the chirping of birds in the background, hopefully that lifts up your spirits too. I know it's still winter in some areas around the country. Snow this week blowing through the Midwest, Mid-Atlantic states. Late April. What are we doing with snow, right? We were supposed to be done with that a few weeks ago. Well, anyways, a slightly different setting from where I'm doing this podcast. And again, normally I'm somebody who's an audio stickler. I want to make sure that everything sounds great and clean and crisp. And well, we'll have some sounds of nature and perhaps some urban noise from the schmucks who don't put mufflers on their cars. So enjoy the sounds of a cool morning in Florida before the insufferable summer heat and humidity moves in here. Now, speaking of insufferable, I think back to baseball cards starting in the mid-1990s. It was such a traumatic experience of getting just pummeled with one set of cards after another that there are some sets and some offshoots of just the baseball card hobby and the industry from back then that I've just kind of buried into the recess of my mind. And the super premium sets are definitely the sets that I've conveniently forgotten about for many years. And you've heard my story before about, you know, 1993, 1994. Yeah, it was a turning point for me, not just in baseball cards, but also just baseball in general, life in general. You know, I'm a teenager. I'm going into my senior year in high school in 1994. You've got the baseball strike and all the things I put a lot of faith and fun into just two or three years earlier, namely baseball and baseball cards. I just decided, I just don't need to do this anymore. And, you know, I went on to live the life as a teenager and eventually as a college student and did all the fun and stupid things that you do at that age. And I remember, you know, the premium cards coming through and then the super premium just seemed to be just totally, like, not even on a back burner. It was on the back of the stove, you know, by the clock on the stove. It wasn't even on a burner. That's just how impactful the super premium cards were for me. And the state of the hobby back in 93, 94, it reminds me of a scene from a movie that was released back in 1983, Monty Python and the Meaning of Life. Now, if you're an aficionado of the Monty Python and the Flying Circus franchise, you know of the TV show. You are probably most familiar with the feature film Monty Python and the Search for the Holy Grail. They also had a wickedly funny movie released a few years after that, Monty Python and the Life of Brian, which is very controversial, depending on your religious views, but still very entertaining. And, you know, in The Meaning of Life, it was basically a feature film almost kind of built around several different sketches that just kind of took you through the different stages of life. And near the end of the movie, one of the greatest sketches is the sketch of Mr. Creosote, who was played by the late Terry Jones. And John Cleese was a snotty waiter, which is a character he plays extremely well. And Mr. Creosote was this roughly 600-pound behemoth who goes waddling into a restaurant. And John Cleese sits him down and proceeds to basically bring everything that the restaurant can cook to Mr. Creosote's table. And Mr. Creosote eats everything, and he is just, you know, practically regurgitating food. Actually, he's literally doing it. He's puking all over the place. And he's clearly just had enough. Like, there's just no more that he can eat. But John Cleese, as the snotty waiter, is looking to get Mr. Creosote to eat just one bit of dessert. And as Cleese's character puts it in the movie, "Would you like a after-dinner mint?" And Mr. Creosote, who again is just this fat, booming, gassy, annoying character, you know, he goes, "Oh, bug off." And Cleese brings out this tiny little mint on this big plate and goes, "It's only a wafer thin." And long story short, Cleese eventually convinces Creosote to eat this wafer thin mint. And just moments after Mr. Creosote swallows this mint, his whole body explodes. It's quite a gross but really funny special effect here, watching this huge man just blow up all over the place. And to me, that was kind of the state of the hobby back around this time. We were all Mr. Creosote. You know, we were once young and slender. We were once just tops. Then we put on a few pounds, you know, just a little flab with Fleer and Donruss in the 80s. And then we just started laying on the carbs, you know, Score, Upper Deck Bowman by the late 80s. And by the end of the 1992 baseball season, we were now just, you know, drinking gravy from the bottom of the saucepan with Stadium Club and Leaf and Fleer Ultra and all of these other premium sets. So along comes Fleer Flair, as well as a couple of other notable sets at that time. Upper Deck SP was one of the super premium sets that also came out, as well as Topps Finest. And collectively, Flair, Finest, and SP, they concocted the wafer thin mint. And the wafer thin mint tastes good. You know, it's chocolate with a hint of mint, and it is only wafer thin. So it was of high quality. It was très magnifique. It was a perfect way to top off the gluttony of the evening. And that's not to say anything wrong about Fleer Flair or Topps Finest or Upper Deck SP. They were all fine sets. But I think I speak for a lot of collectors at that time. Once we consumed the wafer thin mint of super premium sets, many of us just exploded. That was it. We were done. Forget about it. And that was certainly the case for me. And again, my story also revolves around, you know, being a teenager in high school and, you know, being just really dissuaded by, you know, how things played out with the Major League Baseball strike in 1994 and 1995. But I think a lot of people just in the hobby itself, even if you take out some of those other factors, once we got this third and fourth and fifth layer of cards that we were supposed to buy, it was just too much. But like many of the cards that were released around this time, there is still a chance to buy them because they are still, even though they were printed in shorter runs, smaller runs than, you know, some of the other sets at the time, there is still enough out there. And because of a lack of star power or big rookie cards, there is still some affordability here. So much like some of the previous Stadium Club and Ultra sets and you know, some of the other premium sets that we've talked about, much like those, you can still find some pretty good bargains and some pretty nice sets to either hand collate or you can, you know, pick up some pretty easily. And Fleer Flair was a set that was actually suggested to us by a few of our listeners. So we decided to dive in, picked up a few packs of Flair online. And I do have a couple of leftover ones, so I'm going to hang on to them. I know we did this recently where I had some extra packs from some purchases, and I packaged them together and sold them with the money going right back into the program. So that's something that we may do with the Ultra Packs as well, or not the Ultra Packs, the Flare Packs, as well as some other packs that I'll be purchasing soon. Now, what will I be purchasing soon? Funny you should ask. We did run a survey on our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter timeline recently. Looking at the 1980s sets, I put up four options, you know, which is a set that we've discussed before. But since we first discussed it maybe 3-4 years ago, you know, we've kind of just left it behind. You know, we walked forward and did other things. Which of the four options would you like for us to revisit? And the options were 83 Fleer, 85 Tops, 85 Fleer, and 87 Donruss. And this was somewhat of a surprising result. I say somewhat because I know a lot of collectors have a soft spot for this set. But I really thought the 85 Tops set would run away with this. 85 Tops actually finished second in the voting. However, 87 Donruss was the winner. Now, because it was a close vote, it was a 36% to 33% victory for 87 Donruss. We'll take a look at both sets over the course of the next few months. But I was somewhat surprised because I know a lot of collectors consider 1987 kind of the beginning of the junk wax era. For me, I consider 88. That's when score comes in. That's when production numbers go up, quality of stars and rookies goes down. And then, of course, you know, the deluge, the extra flab of Bowman and Upper Deck comes around in 89. And then we all eventually turned into Mr. Creosote. So 87 Donruss, we'll get around to a program on that, 85 Tops as well. And I don't have the results yet as I speak because I just put this poll up. But we are also taking a look at some of the junk wax era sets too. And I'm just curious, out of four options, which one would you like to do a show on? And, you know, went combing through the options and I decided, okay, we'll do 89 Donruss. We will also do 1990 Fleer, 1991 Score, and 1992 Triple Play. That was a Donruss product. And I don't want to sway the voting, but I always had a soft spot for Triple Play, and in fact, probably too soft of a spot because I bought a lot of that as a kid. And now I kind of look back at it, and I'm like, you know, I used to beat myself up for buying a lot of 88 Tops when I was younger. I'm really not sure why I spent so much money on Triple Play. It was a fun set. It was a neat set, but I really wish I had some of that money back. I could have invested it a little better. But, you know, hey, regrets. We've all had a few. Also, while we're talking on the Twitter timeline here, a quick correction from our past program. We were talking about the foodstuff cards, and that was a fun deep dive. Brian Krause, who was one of the big supporters of doing a show about the food co-op cards, was a little dejected that I didn't mention Burger King cards enough in the program, and that was partially by design. First of all, because the Burger King cards are probably the best known, you know, not including the cereal sets, but of the kind of the fast food co-op sets that we focus mostly on in the last program. The Burger King set is fairly well known. So I didn't want to spend too much time on that. And in a case where my brain thinks one thing and my mouth says another, I implied that there was this entire 1979 Topps Burger King set. And I stand corrected because in 79, Burger King created only, or Topps, I should say, two team sets, the Yankees and the Phillies. So my bad. Sorry about that. I do know that there were other top sets that were essentially mirrors of the base set that were associated with some of these co-op sets. But I do stand corrected. So I thank you, Brian. And by the way, and I mentioned this in the podcast, too, it is very easy to get not just in 1979, but other years that the Burger King sets were out there, like 1977. It is very easy to get them confused with the base set cards because there's no big fat Burger King logo on there. So, you know, just beware of that. You know, if you're shuffling through a box of some late 70s cards, make sure if it's a Yankees or a Phillies card that the card number actually corresponds with the base set if you're building that base set, or vice versa, you're building the team set. Because that's actually happened to me a couple times before. I mentioned a Mike Schmidt card that I had from 1979. That was actually the Burger King card. Same thing while I was updating my hand-collated 1977 top set. I was trying to figure out why Mike Torres was card number 7 in the set. I'm like, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. Oh, wait, it's the Burger King card. Whoops. So that's an easy and common mistake to make there. So again, Brian, thank you so much for the correction there. I stand corrected. Again, it's something I knew, but when I blurted it out, it came out slightly off the mark there. A couple other quick Twitter comments before we talk about the Fleer Flare show. Oh, I say that five times real fast. Brian Kilby asking, has there been an episode on trading card media? No, and this would be an interesting kind of off the topic topic to have where we're not focused solely on cards, but around some periphery. And we have not done that, but it is a very interesting idea. And I've mentioned before, I have connections with Beckett, and I may reach out to them just to see if we can have a spokesperson maybe tell us the tale of Dr. Beckett and how the Beckett Baseball Card Monthly Price Guide came out and how it really set the tone for you know, how cards were priced and graded, and they still do. Of course, you know, you're not seeing the hard copy magazines anymore. It's all online. And Beckett's had to, you know, adjust to the changes, not just in the hobby, but just in consumer habits as well. And it'll be interesting to see how they've managed to do that over the years, too. So, Brian, I appreciate the commentary and the suggestion. It is something that we're going to take into consideration. And there was a little bit of a conversation around the publications, including there was a Baseball Card Monthly price guide. There was Tough Stuff. Remember Tough Stuff? Tough Stuff was the Sammy Hagar of card price guides. Like, there was, you know, some good stuff in the Tough Stuff guides. I remember it was cheaper than Beckett Baseball Card Monthly, but you get what you pay for. You know, nobody would legitimately, or at least take seriously, a price listing in Tough Stuff. Like, Beckett was the benchmark. And if it wasn't in Beckett, or if the number you had was different than what was in Beckett, then your number didn't matter. So, you know, Beckett had a stranglehold. And of course, eventually they rolled out price guides for all the other sports and even non-sports as time went on. But that is a topic that we will take a look at some point in time. So again, thank you for the suggestion. Also a suggestion from Uncle Nani. When will you feature one of the greatest and unique commons ever, Topps 1975, number 407? That, of course, designated runner, Herb Washington. Well, we've done a few dives into the 1975 Topps set, so I can't really do another one. And also, it's not exactly a situation where we're randomly selecting this card here. However, this segs nicely into our conversation about waxandgumstains.com, the website that will start to get built out over the next few weeks and months here. Like I said, this will be a work that's going to take some time because I want to get it right. And I appreciate the increase in survey participants. If you still have not taken the waxandgumstains.com survey, if you go to our Twitter profile at waxandgumstains, just click on the link that is in our Twitter profile. That will take you to a SurveyMonkey link. It's 5 questions. Takes about a minute. It's all multiple choice too. There's no math, okay? I promised you there would be no math. It's pretty simple. Just want to get some basic thoughts about how you feel about the program as it is now, what more we could be doing, and on top of that, the website. I want to get the website right. I want it to be a complement to this podcast that we are doing. And another benefit of the website is we can focus in the podcast about particular sets like we have for years now. But the website will help us, you know, do the feature of the odd card, such as number 407 from 75 Tops. It could also help us take a look at non-baseball cards. There are some fun football and basketball and hockey cards that I have that I'd like to talk about, but a lot of our listeners don't want to hear it on the podcast, so we will offer, you know, this second, you know, look at cards online. So yeah, that is something that we may discuss at waxandgumstains.com once the site is up and running, hopefully sometime this summer. And again, if you haven't taken the survey, please just take a minute or two, click on the link that is on our Twitter profile at waxandgumstains. And that'll pretty much do it for the housekeeping there. Thanks to everybody who chimed in on Wax and Gumstains on Twitter. And again, the main focus of today's show is all around a listener suggestion, or a few listeners who suggested the 1993 Flair set. And Flair is, again, it's one of those sets I never really got into just because I was so focused on base sets, a couple of premium sets in 1993. But also my love for vintage sets was really starting to come through. You know, all throughout my teenage years, I would occasionally buy older cards from the 60s and 70s. I would go to flea markets, or, you know, I go to a card shop and maybe they'd have a box of old cards, you know, 400 or 500 cards, and they'd say, yeah, we'll sell it to you for $20. Okay, boom, here you go. And it's because many of the cards were commons, and, you know, nobody really then dove into the vintage cards. So I would buy them, and you know, I was focusing on, you know, learning more and starting to grow my vintage collection. So, you know, I just couldn't put too much time or thought into some of the super premium sets that were coming out at that time. But especially with Flair, all right? First of all, nowadays, when I think of Flair, I think of the movie Office Space and, you know, all the buttons and stickers and suspenders and all the stupid stuff that the restaurant workers had to wear. I forget the name of the restaurant, but it's where Jennifer Aniston's character is. And, you know, her manager's giving a hard time because she's supposed to have a minimum of 15 pieces of Flair on her. And she gets really upset later on in the movie and decides to show her Flair in the form of a middle finger to the manager. So every time I hear the word Flair, I just start chuckling because I think of Office Space. So, but also, you know, Flair. All right, so there's Ric Flair. We all love Ric Flair, right? Woo! Who doesn't like Ric Flair? But then, you know, Flair is just, I don't know. It's a fashion runway word. It's it's a home design catalog word. Just flair. All right, so you've got the alliteration, fleer, flair. All right, that works. But there was just something about the word. I'm like, wait a minute, I don't want flair. I just want baseball cards. Don't give me flair. But yet, that's what Fleer decided to go with. It was indeed Flair in 1993. Like I said, you had Upper Deck SP. They just decided to be the cool kids on the block and named their Super Premium set with the abbreviated Super Premium. And then you had Topps Finest, which made it sound like a fine wine. So you can already see how the Super Premium status was being laid upon these cards. You either had the ultra cool Gen X abbreviation, SP. You had Finest for Topps, as if it were some selection of wine. And then you had Flair from Fleer. And these sets were, generally speaking, a step above of what was already being produced. Upper Deck, of course, already had a pretty premium product in their base sets. Topps had Stadium Club. Fleer had Ultra. Well, we've already got these premium sets. Let's make them even bigger and better. Ooh. So you not only had the fancy names, but you also had fancy packaging. And Fleer was no doubt one of the fanciest yet most frustrating packages you had to open. And I was able to express this while opening it up during our video break, and that's on our YouTube channel. Type in Wax Ecstatic 1993 Fleer Flair Break, and you'll see this. And don't forget to please subscribe to the new YouTube channel. Thank you very much. But you, first of all, had the packages. They were kind of in little mini cardboard boxes. So in the short time span from 1991 to 1993, Fleer cards had gone from your typical wax packaging to cellophane. We've bypassed foil or plastic wrapping, and we've gone straight to hermetically sealed mini cardboard boxes. It was kind of ridiculous. And on top of that, you had these individually wrapped cardboard boxes. So you had to, you know, unwrap a little bit of plastic. Then you had to remove this gold home plate from the top. You would slide the top of the box off. So it almost had a look and feel of a box of premium cigarettes, which, thinking back to, you know, Joe Camel, and, you know, there was the big fight of Joe Camel back in the day. I cringe at it now because I'm sure that Fleer didn't intend to make their cards look like cigarettes, but boy, they sure were packaged that way. So you take the home plate off the top, and then, aha, here are my 10 cards. Oh, wait, those are wrapped in plastic too. So then you got to go unwrapping all this plastic. So now I'm also cringing because I'm thinking of all the garbage we're putting in the environment here, especially plastic. So Fleer Flair definitely bucking two big trends in the early 90s. A, kids smoking, and B, plastic waste in the environment. Once you finally got through these various layers of security, then you finally get to the cards, which are actually extremely nice. So even though I was put off by the whole idea of super premium sets back then, and especially something called Fleer, I still liked the cards once you finally broke through the security mechanisms to see what they looked like. First of all, you will notice they are super glossy. There was like three layers of UV coating that were put on these cards. You will also notice that they are incredibly thick. 24-point cardstock. This is extremely thick cardstock. Not like a drink coaster thickness to it, but certainly not your 81 Donruss flimsy kind of cardstock here. This was some very premium cardstock, and you didn't even think of bending these cards because you probably would need a pair of vice grips to actually do that. Now, because the cards were super thick and super glossy, you had to dedicate pretty much all the space to photography, right? Well, Fleer actually does that. There are no borders. It's basically one big action shot, but one of the neat yet laughingly bad photo effects here is what I like to call the 1970s Olin Mills school picture. You know what I'm talking about, where, and in fact, you probably have one of these in your collection from when you were a kid. But there's the main picture of you sitting there smiling, looking at the camera. And then there's the ghostly visage of you, often above your shoulder, typically looking off in the other direction. And you're either lovingly eyes and mouth wide open, like gazing at the stars, or you're just kind of like staring, like you've totally lost your train of thought. And, you know, we laugh at those pictures. They are comedically brought back these days as gag gifts. You've even seen, you know, some of these are used in advertisements, movie posters as well for comedy films. You know, it's just a really corny 1970s photo technique that was very much in practice for several years. And again, especially with school pictures. So Flair decided to kind of go with this, where you have the action shot dominating, but then you've got this floating head from the players just kind of sitting there. And some of them are unique. For example, a Randy Johnson card that we pulled, because it's Johnson in his windup in two different situations, it almost looks like there is a Siamese twin of Randy Johnson, or perhaps an alien bursting out of Randy Johnson's shoulder. Another one, and this will be one of our players we feature in the bottom of the order, David Justice. This floating head is just so big, and in the spot of empty seats, it actually looks like those cardboard cutouts of athletes' heads that you see at games these days. It's been kind of a popular thing the last few years. So you look around the crowd, you just kind of see these cardboard heads kind of bobbing around there. It looks like Flair was well ahead of the curve with this ginormous David Justice head floating in the seats of Fulton County Stadium in 1993. So, you know, it was comic. It was definitely different. There were no other baseball cards that were running, you know, that kind of design at the time. But when you think of it as the 1970s Olin Mills look, you just kind of shake your head and laugh, because that's essentially what they were doing then. The backs of the cards are very nice. Again, primarily action shots or slightly animated pose shots, I guess you can call it, you know, like a guy warming up on the sidelines before a game, or, you know, at batting practice, stuff like that. And you would have stats listed at the bottom of the page. You had a little bit of narrative, and the narrative would start with a big gold foil letter. And the card number was stamped also in gold foil in the upper left-hand corner. Speaking of gold foil, I should not fail to mention that the player's name was embossed in gold foil at the bottom of the front of the card in a kind of a faux, I don't want to say an autograph, but it was kind of in this cursive, fancy type setting. So keeping up with the standard of the time, 1993, gold foil. Boy, if you could just wrap yourself in gold foil, you could call yourself a baseball card in 1993. So you've got some pretty high quality cards, and Olin Mills photography aside, a pretty solid effort by Flair. Great photography, interesting mix of photography. The glossiness is good. The UV coating, the cards don't stick, which is a good thing, or at least the ones that I've had, they don't stick. And then, you know, on top of that, the cardstock too being so thick and solid, you didn't have to really worry about too much flexing or bowing or creasing. And because of the multi layers of security, as much as I joke about it, it did, for the most part, keep your cards in mint condition. Now, unless you were just tossing these packs around or dropping boxes on the ground, you know, that could have put a ding in them. But for the most part, you kept them relatively safe, at the very least because of all the cushioning from all the plastic and the gold-plated cigarette box look that Flair was able to create there. Now comes the downsides. The set was only 300 cards. So, you know, it was a pretty short set, which meant that you didn't exactly get every player that was in the major leagues. In fact, it comes out to about, less than half of the major league players at the time in 1993. But also because it's 1993 and there's no Derek Jeter card to freak out about, there's not a whole lot of super rookie card power. And this is something that, depending on the set, tended to be a problem in 1993 or 1994. There were some much heralded rookies. There were some big names being bantied about. But even though there's star power, there's not that one card. You know, it's not like 93 Bowman, Mariano Rivera. You know, it's not one of those situations. Or 92 Bowman, Mariano Rivera, I should say. So, you know, you didn't have that one, you know, big name must have rarity rookie card. You did have some rookie cards. In fact, some that were in a subset called Wave of the Future, which was supposed to be this exclusive, hard-to-find subset, yet it says right on the package that there's the Wave of the Future, the odds of getting one was one in every four packs. So it wasn't that exclusive. There were 20 cards in the Wave of the Future set, couple notable names, namely Mike Piazza and also Manny Ramirez. And you could say Tim Salmon would have been a big name back in 1993. But other than that, you get the Rondell Whites of the world, like we did in our pack pull. So that's one thing that bogs down the set. It's a small set, and it doesn't quite have the heavy-hitting rookie power outside of that Piazza and Ramirez Wave of the Future cards. It's a neat subset. But it just doesn't have, you know, six or seven huge names, you know, true rookie cards, not just a rookie nomination. Because as you know, if you collected cards, you didn't have to wait for the 1993 Fleer Flair to get a Manny Ramirez card or a Mike Piazza card. You know, many of these cards were already out in the 1992 sets, so... Yeah, it was a quote-unquote rookie card, or it was a Wave of the Future card, but by this point in time, there were already 10 other cards for both Manny Ramirez and Mike Piazza. Now, another downside is that even though Fleer claimed that the production for Fleer was at 15% less than Fleer Ultra, which Fleer also proclaimed was less than the base set, still in 1993, companies such as Fleer were putting out sets that were printing out, you know, 5 or 6 million of each card. And that, of course, is why there is still a glut of junk wax ads out there, because even if you cut a press run for, say, 25% of what the base set is, that is still, you know, 3 to 4 million cards that were produced and many that are still floating around out there. So there is not exactly scarcity. Is Fleer a little less available than Ultra? Yep. Is it a little less available than the base set in 1993? Yep. But still, in the grand scheme of things, there's a lot of it that is still out there. Now, that turns into a benefit, however, if you're a collector. First of all, by having just 300 cards in the set, and by 300 cards, I mean 297 player cards and three checklists, as well as the 20-card Wave of the Future, if you're looking to complete that and jam it all into a 330-count box, you can. Well, the good thing is, if you buy one wax box of Fleer Flair, there is a very good chance, in fact, it is extremely likely, that you will be able to complete that set, possibly even the Wave of the Future cards, with just one box. Or you complete the base set, and if you want to add the Wave of the Future, you're probably purchasing just 10 or 12 cards. And again, outside of Piazza and Ramirez, not really big names. So you can probably purchase those 10 or 12 cards for a grand total of $2 or $3. You know, there's not a ton of money that has to go into it. So that's a positive. That's very similar to the Stadium Club sets, because they were released in three series in 1993. If you bought a box of 93 Stadium Club Series 1, there was a very good chance that you were able to complete that series just with that one box. You didn't have too many duplicates. So that's a positive. Another thing is, because of the glut, even though it was at a reduced print run than some of the other Fleer sets or other card sets in general that were made in 1993, you can still find plenty of Fleer for relatively inexpensive prices. Now, I say relatively because right now the baseball card hobby is going through a very stupid phase of price inflation. And if you follow me, follow my personal account on Twitter, Salmon Says, you saw me gripe about this a few weeks ago, where I'm doing some shopping for the show, and I'm looking at just, you know, very generic, for starters, you know, baseball wax packs or wax boxes search. And I'm seeing, you know, boxes of 89 score on sale for $40. And I just went, whoa, all right. If anyone actually pays $40 for a box of 89 score, you deserve to have your bank account completely drained. That's on you, buddy, because you clearly do not know better if you're dropping $40 for a box of 89 score. I don't care if there's Ken Griffey Jr. and Edgar Martinez and a few other star players in there. There's just nothing in 89 score that's worth $40. In fact, for $40, you could probably go out and at your local cards shop or at a card show, you could probably buy 8 sealed factory sets of 89 score for $40. Now, granted, what the price is on eBay doesn't necessarily mean that's what people will pay for it. But I think we've got way too many people now. We've got a whole bunch of amateur stock traders now involved in the game here who are just trying to charge an arm and a leg for cards that are just not going to bring back any return on investment other than the sentimental happiness you get when you open up a box full of cards like you did when you were a kid. So we're seeing the exploitation of 90s nostalgia right now. I've complained about current releases, you know, new cards. It's hard to get a hold of them because you've got people hoarding them. They don't even sit on store shelves anymore. Good luck finding them at a Target or Walmart. They're gone pretty much as soon as they arrive. But you're seeing that now with junk wax. It's one thing if it's vintage wax. If somebody wants to put a couple of packs of 73 tops up there and, you know, put a price of $800 up there, well, you know, there's some real scarcity in that. You know, it's a set that's almost 50 years old. There's some bona fide rookie cards and star cards. You know, you get that Carlton Fisk second year card, you get the Mike Schmidt rookie. I mean, there's a lot to be had in that situation. Again, 89 score, what are we doing? I rue the day that somebody actually pays that money for a set like that. So, you know, this is Uncle Matt's reminder to you that the only people who are making money off of junk wax these days are the people who are selling it, the people who have sat on it for years, and they're not making a ton of money. You know, that box that used to sell for $10, they can now mark up to $15 and justify it. There is an audience that will pay that. But buyer beware, again, as always. Fleer Flair, I did do a check just a couple of years ago. You could have bought a whole box of Fleer Flair for $20. Nowadays, it's creeped up to the $30 to $40 range. So shop around a little bit. It might actually behoove you, instead of buying an entire box, maybe just buy a few lots of individual packs or groups of packs. You know, somebody may sell you 5 packs for $12. Well, you know, maybe you can negotiate the price down there and get a couple of different lots out of it. But again, you can still find these relatively cheap. And if you're into super premium sets that are loaded with stars, make no doubt about it. There are some Hall of Famers here and some notable names in the Fleer Flair set of 1993. But you're not too concerned about a lack of rookie power, then this is definitely a set that you'll want to look in. I will say, too, even though you're going to pay a little more because of the quality of the set, because it is somewhat more scarce than everything else that was put out in 1993, and again, because prices are going up, as unfair as that is, it is money that would be well invested, in the sense of if you just want an A++ set to put together. I don't think spending $30 or $40 on a box is that ridiculous. And like I said, whatever wave of the future cards you need to find, that's not going to cost you too much. So this is one of those higher end boredom killer sets. You know, you probably didn't plan on doing this, but if you are a child of the 80s or early 90s and you want to go down memory lane and look back at some of the players who were big news back then this is definitely a good option for you. Now, let's get to the bottom of the order here as we take a look at three players randomly selected from the packs. One is the player that I was talking about who had the ginormous head floating next to him while he was at bat. David Justice, who in 1993, if you pulled a David Justice card, it was still worth a lot of money. It was a big hit for you back in 93, even though he had a tough 1991 and 1992 season. Of course, David Justice comes blasting onto the scene in 1990 as the Rookie of the Year, born in Covington, Kentucky. That's the south side of Cincinnati, if you will. A star player at Covington Latin School. He was making his major league debut in May of 1989 with the Atlanta Braves. As the Braves are retooling and moving star player, in fact, franchise cornerstone Dale Murphy to Philadelphia in August of 1990, well, Justice basically moves into his slot in the outfield and grabs everyone's attention. Playing just half a season, manages to notch 28 home runs, and like I said, wins the National League Rookie of the Year award. So David Justice was part of that early 90s rookie splurge. Everyone was looking for David Justice cards, Kevin Moss, Todd Van Poppel, you name it. Well, Justice had a little more shelf life than some of those other players here. Now, in 1991, he had to deal with a back injury throughout much of the summer, did still manage to play in the Braves' worst-to-first phenomenal run to the World Series, which they fell just short to the Minnesota Twins. Again, had a slightly off 1992 season, but had a tremendous season in 1993. 40 home runs, 120 RBI, and he was a top candidate for the National League MVP, which was won by Barry Bonds, Lenny Dykstra coming in second, and in comes David Justice, who followed up that solid 93 season with another impressive 1994 season, which, like everybody else, was cut short. When the strike came about in August of 1994, Justice was hitting .313, had a .531 slugging average as well. Now comes 1995. This would be a pivotal point in Justice's career, as he and the Atlanta Braves are having a phenomenal season. Of course, they're starting to just be a buzzsaw in the playoffs. And after the Braves took a 2-0 lead in the World Series against the Cleveland Indians, well, the Indians put on a little bit of a rally. And after three games in Cleveland, it's a 3-2 Braves lead in the series. Well, Justice, before game six, he's approached by reporters, and he's acknowledging that he and his teammates are under immense pressure. And think about it. You know, the Braves were in the World Series in 1991, 1992. They just got edged out by the Phillies in the NLCS in 1993. They probably would have been a contender in 1994, although who's to say, considering the Montreal Expos had that great season in 94 cut short. But, you know, here they are in 1995. After all of these times where they've gotten close to a World Series, you're thinking, okay, the Atlanta Braves have to win a World Series. Like, it's now or never, boys. So they're under immense pressure, and especially after taking that 2-0 series lead, Cleveland winning 2 of 3 in Cleveland. So they're back in Atlanta, and Justice is kind of spouting off about the pressure. And then he just kind of starts trashing the fans in Atlanta. And even though the fans were there, it's not like they were playing in an empty stadium. Even though Fulton County Stadium was sold out, and even though they're doing the tomahawk chop and all that other nonsense, the Cleveland fans are just cheering nonstop, win or lose, ahead, behind. And of course, a big reason for that is the Indians, this was their first World Series since 1954. You know, there's a couple of generations of Indians fans who had no idea what it was like to be in a World Series. So, I mean, they're just bubbling with excitement. It's not all that different from what you saw in Atlanta in 1991. You know, the Braves were just this moribund team for so many years. Finally, you had a reason to get excited. So, you know, Justice basically says, you know, hey, if we fall behind, we're going to get booed. If we lose this game, they're going to burn our houses down. Meanwhile, in Cleveland, they're cheering their team on. So, you know, we got to take a lead and whatever. Well, the cat's out of the bag. And the papers, of course, the reporters all run out there and put out this story. You know, oh, David Justice says that, you know, Atlanta fans are going to burn down their houses, and, you know, Cleveland fans are more energetic. And he faces the wrath of the fans in Game 6. Well, fortunately for David Justice, he actually delivers. You know, it's very similar to Mark Messier's guarantee in the 1994 Eastern Conference semifinal, or the finals, I should say, the conference final. 3-3 series, or I'm sorry, 3-2, Devils lead the Rangers, and Messier guarantees a win. And, the Rangers would go on to win that series in 7 games and eventually go on to win the Stanley Cup that year. Same thing here with the Braves and David Justice. He kind of just shoots off his mouth about how the Indians fans are a little more passionate than the Braves fans. And, the Braves fans are, putting a lot of pressure on the Braves players. So he faces the Boo Birds, but he delivers by hitting a home run. It turns out to be the only run in Game 6. And the Braves finally clinch their first and what is still amazingly only world championship in Atlanta in 1995, the franchise's first championship since 1957. So in comes 1996, the Braves are defending champions. Justice is off to a good start. However, very bizarre injury. Swings and misses in a game against Pittsburgh, actually throws out his shoulder, separates his shoulder, and that's the end of his 1996 season. Well, with the Braves looking to stay young and stay contending and moving the often injured Justice off to the side, they decide to trade him, ironically, to Cleveland. So Justice, alongside Marquise Grissom, gets sent to Cleveland in exchange for Kenny Lofton and Alan Embry. So what do you know, in 1997, Justice is back in the World Series after hitting 329 in the 1997 season with 33 home runs, helps the Indians make it to the World Series. And again, the Indians losing a heartbreaker in 7 games to the Florida Marlins. He had a pretty solid run in 1998 and 1999. Levels off a little bit in 2000. However, despite hitting only 286 that season with the Indians and the Yankees, more on the Yankees in a moment, managed to clobber 41 home runs. Now, the Yankees in 2000, of course, they're under pressure to keep their dynasty going at this point in time, and they're looking to add a big bat. Well, the Yankees are trying to land Sammy Sosa from the Cubs. The Cubs ain't moving him. They're trying to land Juan Gonzalez from the Texas Rangers. The Rangers ain't moving him. So Brian Cashman pulls off a deal with the Indians, where Justice comes into the Indians or to the Yankees, excuse me, in exchange for some pretty notable up and coming youngsters, not stars here, but some notable names in Jake Westbrook, Zach Day, and Ricky Lede. Well, Justice gets totally re-energized in the 2000 ALCS, and in fact, is the ALCS MVP after a very productive series, and then he would win a World Series with the Yankees against the Mets in 2000. He would continue to battle injuries throughout 2001 after the 2001 season, again playing in another World Series, this time losing to the Arizona Diamondbacks. The Yankees trade Justice to the Mets in exchange for Robin Ventura. The Mets then flip Justice to Oakland in exchange for pitchers Tyler Yates and Mark Guthrie. He would play for the A's in 2002. And then would eventually wind down his season and actually his career as well. And in fact, was part of the Moneyball experiment in Oakland as assistant GM Paul DePodesta was looking to see if a player like Justice was able to continue to get on base despite his age. There was a theory that the older a player got, he was more selective with the pitches that he swung at, and he could build up his on-base percentage as opposed to puffing up his batting average or slugging percentage. You know, just get batters on base and get some runners. That's how the A's were trying to build that Moneyball team back then. And it actually, the hypothesis proved correct in the case of David Justice. Now, with the 2002 season done, he would wrap up his career, 279 batting average, also had 1,571 hits, 305 home runs, and 1,017 RBI. Now, he had some controversy, not just a rather acrimonious split from a shortened marriage with actress Halle Berry in the late 1990s, but he was also implicated in the Mitchell Report. Now, even though Justice denied ever using steroids or any kind of human growth hormone or stuff like that, he did admit that he had talked about HGH with a trainer with the Yankees, and he was looking into it, but he claims that he never actually did it. Of course, that's kind of like, you know, the old Bill Clinton line, I once smoked pot, but I never inhaled it. You know, when it comes to steroids and sports, and especially Major League Baseball at this point in time, if you were entertaining the thought of it, there is a chance that you somehow got mixed up with it. Even the thought of doing some kind of performance enhancement drugs was a no-no. And that certainly dinged his Hall of Fame potential. I don't think he was ever going to get into the Hall, but he only received one vote. The Hall of Fame vote came around the same time as the Mitchell Report. He had started a broadcasting career, just as did with the YES Network, decided to not come back to YES after the 2007 season. Some people say it's because of the Mitchell Report. Others, including Justice, say it's because he needed to be away from the broadcast booth because he had a house fire at his home in San Diego that he had to attend to, and that just, you know, kind of took his eye off the ball there, if you will. So even though he claims that he did not do steroids, he was a big proponent of anybody who was ensnared in the Mitchell Report, innocent or not, to rat out those who were guilty of taking performance-enhancing drugs. He was one of those guys, again, who said that he didn't do it. He kind of thought about it but didn't get involved, but just even thinking about it got him ensnared in that whole mess. Now, what has David Justice been up to? Well, you still see him occasionally on television. He's also in the Braves Hall of Fame, and he has married Rebecca Villalobos, the CEO of Exotic Spices Calendars. They've got three kids, and you may have noticed the Justices in a rousing episode of Celebrity Wife Swap back in 2014. Yay. All right, let's talk about Roberto Hernandez, shall we? This is actually a very interesting story, but those of us who live in Tampa Bay, you remember Roberto Hernandez as the tension and sweat-inducing closer for the Tampa Bay Devil Rays in their first couple of seasons. It was always an adventure when Roberto came out to the mound to try to close out a game. Now, there are other Roberto Hernandezes involved in baseball. This is the relief pitcher, Roberto Manuel Hernandez Rodriguez, the Puerto Rican born in November of 1964. A great story of how he was even discovered. His family leaves Puerto Rico and goes to New York City when he's 2 years old. And he's playing baseball, but he had to drop out of baseball in high school because his mother was sick. There were a lot of hardships in the family. And he eventually signs on to play with the University of Connecticut in 1984. And he actually started out as a catcher. He was the starting catcher for the team in the 1985 season. Well, after the 1985 season, he is playing in a summer league in Virginia, and he's talking to a coach, and he's like, you know, I really want to be a pitcher. So the coach relents, gets him into a game. They play a team from Madison, and Roberto Hernandez makes quite the impression because he strikes out 14 batters in this appearance. Now, he would get a couple other starts here, but the manager was resigned to keeping Roberto as a catcher and not a pitcher. Now, another interesting angle to the Hernandez story is he was having trouble really breaking through with UConn. So he decides that he wants to change schools. He wants to attend the University of South Carolina in Columbia, but he couldn't get a letter of consent. He had trouble getting his the attention of his baseball coach in Connecticut. So finally, to avoid sitting out a year of his college eligibility, he was able to get Larry Carr, the pitching coach at rival Coastal Carolina, to put in a good word for him with the coaching staff of the University of South Carolina in Aiken, also known as USCA. So Carr sticks out his neck and says, hey, this guy's good. You need to give him a scholarship. And that's what USCA does. And Hernandez does head over to USCA without ever, you know, visiting the school, and he's hoping to become a pitcher in the 1986 season. Actually has to deal with an arm injury and surgery, but he does come back with full gusto, and he starts attracting the attention of Major League scouts. He was selected by the California Angels in the first round of the 1986 amateur draft, 16th overall, is working his way up through the Angels farm system, where he is traded. Now, this is an interesting trade. This happens in 1991. He's traded to the Chicago White Sox. And, you know, sometimes there are trades, you know, we call them minor deals. You know, they're minor league players or they're players you've never really heard of. And you go, okay, whatever. Well, he's traded along with minor leaguer Mark Doran to the White Sox for Mark Davis. Now, Mark Davis is a utility outfielder who eventually puts up a grand total of 3 games of major league experience with the Angels. So when you know, see that trade happen, it's really just a transaction note, right? But hindsight being 2020, you look back at it and you go, yeah, I think the White Sox got the better of that deal. And he would make his major league debut with the Chicago White Sox shortly after that acquisition. And after a blood clot scare, he had to have surgery done on his forearm. They had to transfer veins from his inner thigh to his forearm to, circulate the blood properly so he didn't have these clots. So Hernandez's major league career almost finished before it started. But thankfully for him, the surgery was successful, and he was able to make his major league debut in September of 1991. Very productive career with the Chicago White Sox, was part of their 1993 playoff team. Was a bona fide closer with them and filling in for some big shoes. You know, Bobby Thigpen was the closer for several years and, you know, had set the saves mark for the American League back in, I think it was 1991. But Roberto comes in and he's routinely saving 30 plus games a year and was a little wild, you know, got a little crazy, especially allowing runs that I'm sure the management didn't like for him to allow, but he was still effective enough to where he could close out games and keep the White Sox competitive throughout the mid-1990s. Now, after the or during the 1997 season, the White Sox decide to blow things up and try to retool for a pennant run a couple years later. So they trade Hernandez along with Wilson Alvarez and veteran Danny Darwin to the San Francisco Giants for 6 prospects, Brian Manning, Ken Vinning, Mike Caruso, Lorenzo Barcello, Bob Howery, and Keith Foulke. Foulke, of course, pretty much the big name in that group there. That was part of the white flag trade. Remember that when the White Sox were not all that far out of contention, but management decided to bite the bullet, make the trade, rebuild on the fly, as opposed to, make a run for it, maybe fall short, and then have a longer run to get back into contention. So he finishes the 1997 season with the Giants, and then in 1998 signs as a free agent with the Devil Rays. He would set a career high for 43 saves in 1999. He was an all-star that season, and that 43 saves, by the way, would be a Rays record up until 2010. He managed to save about 2/3 of the Rays wins that year. 69 games in 1999, he had 43 saves. Now, afterwards, he pretty much bounced around, dealt with some control issues, also reoccurring injuries. Of course, by this point in time, he's in his mid-30s, so that's not totally a surprise. After the 2000 season in Tampa Bay, he would play a couple seasons in Kansas City, a season each in Atlanta and Philadelphia, also the Mets, and then over the final couple years of his career, splitting time with the Mets, the Pirates, the Indians, and the Dodgers. Finishes a 17-year career by appearing in 1,010 games, notching 326 career saves, and having a pretty good earned run average of 3.45. Like I said, he was sweat and tension inducing. He had a good strikeout-to-walk ratio, but sometimes he would just put himself into a tough situation with a batter or runners on base, and then he would finally close it up. I remember he was the first of many relief pitchers / closers in the early days of the Devil Rays that made life interesting. Of course, following Roberto Hernandez was the great Esteban Yan, who was an absolute train wreck in so many ways. As for what's happened to Roberto Hernandez since, pretty much a quiet life. He's married, he's got 4 children, and he lives in Gulfport, Florida. Last but not least, speaking of Florida stars, let's talk about Jeff Conine, who was one of the up-and-coming prospects of the early 90s. Perhaps you had a minor league card of his, or maybe a rated rookie somewhere, then with the Kansas City Royals, but it wasn't until his time with the Florida Marlins that he would really blossom. Born in Tacoma, Washington, a star player at UCLA, although a pitcher at the time. He was drafted in the 58th round of the 87 draft by the Kansas City Royals. Had a couple of brief stints with the Royals. Didn't really grab anyone's attention. Not as a pitcher. By then, he was a position player. But as I said, getting new life with the Marlins. But let's back up a little bit. Like I said, at UCLA, he was a pitcher. In fact, a relief pitcher. And even though he was primarily a pitcher, he wasn't a very good one. The scouting reports were kind of negative on his prospects. And fortunately for Conine, he also played first base rather well. Also, fortunately for Conine, he was a hell of a hitter, and it was his bat that got the attention of the UCLA coaching staff, but also major league teams. In fact, when the Royals were looking to make a draft pick late in that 87 draft, it was UCLA pitching coach Guy Hansen who got a bug in John Schuerholz's ear. Schuerholz, then the GM for the Royals, he said, hey, the best hitter on our team is actually a pitcher. And the Royals drafted Conine, and the rest, as they say, is history. Like I said, had a couple of brief stints with the Kansas City Royals. Didn't really make much of a dent. But he was drafted by the Marlins in the 1992 expansion draft and became a full-time left fielder. He had a standout 1993 season, batting .292, 12 home runs, 79 RBI. Had 162 full games played. So he appeared in every game for the Marlins in their inaugural season and managed to finish third place in the National League Rookie of the Year balloting. Heading into the 1994 strike, he was hitting .313, followed up the 1994 season with a very impressive 1995 season, batting .340 with 9 home runs and 24 RBI just in the month of June, earning him Player of the Month honors then. He would finish the season with a .302 batting average, 25 home runs. Similar numbers in 96, .293, 26 home runs, 95 RBI. Now, the Marlins making a mad dash for a World Series run in 1997. They go out and acquire Moises Alou to play left field. So Jim Leland, the new manager of the team, moves Conine from left field to first base. And Conine would become a star with the Marlins at first base, having a pretty solid series against the Cleveland Indians. In fact, he would have the game-winning RBI. In the NLCS against the Braves, had the game-winning and series-winning RBI in Game 5. And as I mentioned, a pretty solid series against the Marlins. Even though he wasn't the one to really carry the load there, he would come up with some key hits and defensive plays as well. So the Marlins get that World Series in 1997, but Conine is part of the big fire sale as Wayne Huizenga, after spending all that money to win the championship, decides to dump all that money, and they actually trade him back to Kansas City for minor league pitcher Blaine Mull. Now, he had to deal with some back injuries throughout the 1998 season, and he gets traded to the Baltimore Orioles for pitcher Chris Fussell in 1999 and is able to revive his career with the Orioles, batting .291 in 1999, also having a very solid 2000 season, an impressive .311 batting average in 2001, and continues to roll with Baltimore rather well, batting .287 throughout five-plus seasons with the Orioles. Now, the Marlins, again, looking to make a World Series run in 2003. The Orioles looking to dismantle their team by 2003. So the Marlins make the trade for Conine, bringing him back, sending pitching prospects Don Lavinsky and Denny Bautista for Conine. And the regular season was not all that impressive for Conine, batting .239 down the stretch here for the Marlins. However, once they got into the playoffs, again in the NLCS against the Cubs, an absolute stud, batting .458 in that series, and then batting .333 in the World Series against the New York Yankees, which the Marlins would win. So Conine has a rather unique footnote in his career. He is the only player to appear in the opener of the Marlins' inaugural season in 1993. He was also the only player to appear in the opener in 93, be a part of the 97 World Championship team, and part of the 2003 team. Now, he would continue to play for the Marlins through 2005, would later play with the Baltimore Orioles and the Philadelphia Phillies, and bounced around just a little bit near the tail end of his career, ultimately signing a one-day contract with the Marlins to retire as a Marlin. I always thought that was kind of silly when athletes do that, but hey, what do I know? He is Mr. Marlin, finishing up his career. He still holds franchise marks and several notes in the Marlins record book, including most Grand Slam home runs. He had six in his two tours of duty with the Marlins. Now, he would move on to a broadcast career with the Marlins starting in 2008, and he would continue to be a color commentator and studio host through 2017. He was part of the Derek Jeter purge when Jeter first bought the Marlins. Ever since then, he's been kind of off to the side and involved in numerous athletic events, including marathons. He's also a star, dare I say, or maybe an enthusiast might be the right word, for racquetball. That's actually how he met his wife, at a professional racquetball tournament in New York City. He is still married to her, and they still have three kids. So one son drafted first by the Marlins, but not signing, but later drafted by the Toronto Blue Jays. That would be Griffin Conine. So there is another Conine name floating around through Major League Baseball. And if you are an Olympic fan, the Conine name is going to ring a bell for you too, as in Gerald Conine. That is Jeff Conine's father. He represented the United States as a wrestler in the 1964 games. So there's our look at the bottom of the order, the 1993 Fleer Flair set. Like many of the premium sets, even though this is designated a super premium set, you will pay a little bit of a premium price-wise because of the quality of the cards, and also just because prices are getting goosed right now as everyone's cashing in on 90s nostalgia. But despite the lack of big superstar rookie cards, other than the Ramirez and the Piazza Wave of the Future cards, although this Hawk may differ with me on my opinion, but despite the Piazza and Ramirez Wave of the Future cards, not heavy hitting rookie cards here. It is loaded with star power, but because it is part of the junk wax era, I know, I can't believe people would pay $40 for a box of 89 score. But anyways, despite what the Hawk is squawking about, 93 Flair is loaded with some Hall of Fame names, some notable names at 300 cards. It's a relatively easy set to put together. And as I said before, with the purchase of just one wax box, there's a good chance you can actually complete that set with one box. And whatever leftovers you need to have to fill it out, not going to be that difficult or that expensive to do so. So if you like high quality sets, it's worth your time. But if you're like me and you're somebody who just did not get into super premium sets, you were kind of sick and tired of the further splintering of the hobby in the mid-90s, this may not be a set for you, and that's perfectly fine. Whatever makes you happy and you're collecting, that's what you need to be collecting. So that'll finish up our look at 93 Flair. Thank you so much to our listeners who suggested that. It is a nice set, not one that I'm going to try to build, but it was fun to kind of revisit that after pretty much shushing it off 30 years ago, or almost 30 years ago. It was nice for me to kind of reintroduce myself to this particular part of the hobby that I closed myself off to many, many years ago. Now, make sure that you're listening to us, as we'll have another podcast coming your way in just 2 weeks. Of course, we come your way every other Friday. Our next podcast scheduled for Friday, May the 7th. And what will we be talking about? I don't know. Possibly 87 Donruss, possibly 85 Tops, possibly the publications, or maybe we'll revisit a couple of those junk wax sets that we put up on our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter survey recently. But make sure you follow along on Wax and Gum Stains. Don't forget to subscribe to the new Wax Ecstatic YouTube channel. And once again, if you have the chance, please fill out the survey. It takes just a minute. Tell us what you want to see on waxandgumstains.com so that we can build that set properly for you over the next few months. Don't forget, get vaccinated. Don't be hesitant about it. Get that vaccine. Like I said, I'm about to get my second shot. hopefully I'll be feeling okay tomorrow. But I'm really looking forward to this, looking forward to 2 weeks being as less vulnerable to the coronavirus as I have ever imagined. You know, now being able to be around more friends and family without the masking and social distancing, that's a great thing. But in the meantime, schedule those vaccinations, wear those masks, wash your hands, stay social distanced. We are winning this battle. It's going to take a little time, but make sure that you continue to follow those practices so that we can get back to normal sooner rather than later. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We will see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.